we've been looking at the inseparability of being awake and being free. The actuality of those two so-called ways to describe things are one. Being awake is the same as being free. Being free is not a feeling. It's not a state of consciousness. It's certainly not a thought. It's not a bodily state. It's none of those things. Being free is being awake. Being awake means realizing what you are. Through the realization, or you could say realizations, of what you are, it becomes clear what you're not. What you're not is relativity. The fluxations, the transitory, the ephemeral, that which is changing. We've been looking at the possibility that through recognizing what awareness actually is, that spontaneously and in a way at times very clearly, effortlessly, that which appears to be unsatisfactory, to use one simple word, is rendered irrelevant. What is unsatisfactory ultimately is irrelevant, but only through the lens of being awake. You don't become awake. That's what the mind thinks about this stuff. It thinks, I am not awake, and I become awake. The substrata or matrix for the deep sleep, dream, nighttime dream, waking dream, that's this. Experiences, the substrata or matrix within which those things arise, or you could say exist within, is awareness. The world, whatever you call the world, arises in awareness. Awareness isn't in the world. The world is in awareness. It's the opposite of what we at times think. Why? Because the thinking, in this sense now, is connected to the notion of identity. It's connected to what the brain, it's the brain, thinks we are. Now, we can pause right here for a moment and go, what sees the brain? What sees the brain? What is that which is experiencing the brain? And the answer is, if we look closely, it's awareness. Now, what the teachings of awakening, you could say spiritual teachings, do is they uncover this awareness. They unveil it. What it means to see through illusion or delusion or maya, if you use the Hindu term, what that means is to see through the layers of that which isn't true. or to put it differently, to see through the layers of what you think you are, what you've been told you are, and what you in turn end up believing you are. Thought isn't a problem, even though we have on our planet a rich history, mostly coming out of Asia, India in particular, that practices disciplines, very, very detailed, very precise disciplines, yogas, if you will, to quiet, to still the mind. And why is this? There's a reason. Because stilling the mind, stilling the thinking, opens up a space of silence and stillness. The mind itself, the brain itself, can become quite still and silent. And this, practiced effectively, can help open the gate to the identity question. Who are you? What are you? If a person says, where are you? Most human beings, many human beings, not necessarily most, but many, would say, here. And of course that immediately reveals the identity with the body. Without any meditation, children at times, 3, 4, 5-year-old children, will deeply recognize, they will understand experientially, they will realize, they will see directly the transitoriness of the body. They will see a dead animal, squirrel perhaps, bird, and they will recognize the nature of death. They will recognize through that mirror that this very body is transitory, ephemeral. That it was born and that it dies. And if you think you are exclusively this, then you must be subject to that birth and death as well, correct? But in a millisecond or less, awareness reveals something quite different. At least it reveals the mystery, the uncertainty around this notion of birth and death as it relates to your true nature. What you really are. Why is it that some human beings, as death of the body is approaching, become radiant, happy, clear, lucid, transcendent? Is it just because the body's going to drop, and the apparent burdens of the body are going to fall away? Is it because they believe, and they believe maybe their whole life, that I'm going to heaven and everything's going to be wonderful and fine, and all my loved ones will be there, and as my dad used to say, there'll be plenty of watermelon? Watermelon all around? Or is it because the true light of the illuminated consciousness, the illuminated mind, the illuminated true nature of the mind is attempting to dawn for that so-called dying person, dying body? And that mysterious transition where there's something animating this. Clearly there's something animating this. We can establish that very readily, can't we? It animates the flesh, it animates the eyes, it animates the voice, it animates the senses, it animates the emotion, it animates. This animation, boom, gone. Particles, waves, nothingness, mystery. Is that what's appealing to that one who's becoming radiant and happy? Oh, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, translated more recently into the Tibetan Book of the Living and Dying, clearly describes, based on the experiential phenomenological practice of many, many human beings, that if you as a human being, during the waking, dreaming, sleeping, cycles of the body-mind process, do not see or begin to see the true nature of what you are, the true nature of mind, the transcendent, free, radiant, unbounded true nature of what you are, if you don't see it during those 70, 80, 90 chronological years, you may get a very clear chance to see it as the body's ready to drop. You ready? If we think, or we feel, or we believe that there's something profound and beautiful happening when the sun of this solar system hits the skin of this body and we go, whoa, that is far out, that warmth. That is so sweet. I mentioned last week how in Sweden, I think I did. I know, I'm not sure what I say sometimes anymore. But the you know, in Sweden where it's very, very, you know, north, right? And so it gets very, very gray. There's a lot of gray, and there's a lot of gray for a lot of months. A lot of it. The sun pops out in Sweden. They don't bother to do what they do in Finland. In Finland, they roll up the sleeves and they pull up the pant legs and they go like that. They sit there. They're sitting around like beetles. Just stuck their bellies up. This Finland move. Okay? In Sweden, they don't even bother to do this. They just strip. Now it's a nudist colony. Less conservative. If we appreciate that light, and most of us do, take the sun away for long enough, and most of us are like, phew, a little sunshine. I used to literally drive across the Bay Bridge. I lived in California. Drive across the Bay Bridge from San Francisco, fogged in the summer with it. Felt like I had a hat on the top of my head pushing down. And the mood would be altered, and I'd be feeling my own version of seasonal affect disorder, which is an interesting acronym in there. It's called SAD. Yeah. And I would literally, just to get to the sun, I would drive across the Bay Bridge, and I'd get over there to Inspiration Point, which is in between Berkeley and Oakland, and just drive up and then hike up to Inspiration Point and just get up there and yell and jump around a little bit, and then I would go back and get in the fog again. Literally, I wouldn't even stop for food or water or anything. Just head for the sun and then back. If we think, if we believe, if we feel that that sun is wonderful, the light of your true nature, our true nature, is so much more profound, deep, gratifying. So much so, when Angulimala and Sariputra, two serious, serious, very serious, ardent, full-time meditative yogis, 2,500 years ago or so, these two dudes came from wealth. They didn't have to work, so they could meditate full-time. So you don't have to come from wealth to meditate full-time. You just need somebody to give you some food. Okay. These guys had the material scene set up, and they were meditating deeply, and they knew they weren't awake. How did they know? Because when you can look at your mind honestly and clearly, you can see where it's still effed up. Can't you? Mm-hmm. We're not judging it. You can see where it's confused. You can see where it's unsorted. You can see where things are still knotted. They could see this very clearly, and they wanted full emancipation. They were full time on this one. And then one day, they saw a monk. This monk was a total glow. A glow. I guess you'd call it the aura. A glow. They looked at him and they thought, my goodness, we must approach. They went up, and imagine this conversation. It was told to me, this is exactly how it happened. They went up and they said, sir, from what it appears to us, it appears you're awake. It appears you're fully emancipated. Imagine this on the streets of Gainesville. The monk responds, absolutely yes. Imagine this on any street, anywhere. Yes, I am. Then they said, who is your teacher? Please tell us, who is your teacher? Oh, Gautama the Buddha is my teacher. Where is he? Oh, he's not that far. He's only a few villages over. You can go to him, he'll teach you. Oh, they were excited. You can imagine a goose flesh. Goose flesh isn't just a tingle. Goose flesh is when your skin actually like lights up. The back of your neck is like anticipating that which is most, most priceless. They said, oh, we can go. They hurried. Maybe they went immediately, I don't remember. They found the Buddha, and within 1 week, each of them, done. And now, you see, I'm telling you this, for the rest of his life, wherever Sariputra was, he would ask the people around him that evening before he went to bed, where is Bhante Asuji? Bhante Asuji was the monk who told him about the Buddha. Where is Bhante Asuji? Where is he now? They said, well, he's in this village last seen over here. Or he's over here, he's over here. And every night for the rest of his life, until the body dropped, Sariputra would ask this question of those nearby. They would tell him, to the best of their knowledge, where Bhante Asuji last was seen. And then he would lie down with his head facing that direction where Bhante Asuji was said to be, out of gratitude. You think the sun is cool? The moon is cool? The river is cool? Beautiful, beautiful children, any children, whether they you call them yours or any children, the face, the smile, the innocence, a puppy that just is free and open and unconditional loving, these things are wonderful. Incomparable. Incomparable to the true nature of what you are. So let's lift back a little bit. Let's ease back from that so-called loftiness that the mind might go. Sounds sweet. It's not how I feel. It's not what's going on over here. What is going on over here? A big part of what's going on over here, there, all around here, is what you think. I think it's this, therefore seems to be this. I think it's that, therefore it seems to be that. Seems to be unsatisfactory, seems to be partially satisfactory. Had a pretty good day. Not that much difficulty happened. Oh my gosh, 1, 2, 3, 4. What are we up to, 7? I'm going to go to bed before more bad things happen. This Sometimes they just line up so-called bad things. Why are they a bad thing? Because you think of it that way. Why? Because it feels that way. Because it feels maybe unfortunate. Oh my gosh, they didn't get the check? I sent it 2 weeks ago. What's going on with the mail? Did I get the wrong address? Why don't they call me back? I already called them. How come this bill is so big? What happened here? Who's unhappy now? Who do I have to take care of to be okay? Oh my gosh, I'm constipated again? Indigestion? What's this on my neck? Oh my gosh, more hair falling out? I don't know what you see. I'm just pulling a few things out of the toaster and see if they fit. Or, it's not necessarily that great, not necessarily that bad. Like, life seems to be relatively balanced. Like, not too many ups, not too many downs. Pretty smooth sailing. A young man called me on the phone. He said, please call me back. I called him back as quick as I can. He's in California. He said, something's happened. I said, what's that? He said, well, I got a blood clot in my arm. And before I could get it treated, it went to my lungs. And they had to rush me to the hospital. And they got it in time. But now my arm is blue. It's swollen again, and they're telling me I have severe thoracic outlet syndrome. And that's why that clot went from my arm into my lung. And I've got to go and have a surgery. And they're going to take out my whole first rib on the left side. He says, I'm not sure at 36 years old I want to lose my whole rib yet. I'm scheduled for surgery in 3 days. How much do you know about thoracic outlet syndrome, Paul? I said, well, I know a fair amount, and I think based on what's going on, you might be somewhat past the bodywork stage for now. You feel good with your so-called advisors medically? You feel good going down to Stanford? You think that's a good place to go for this? What's the percentile success with this surgery? You got a clear read on the potential side effects, complications? Got that information, had it all. Done his homework. He said, you think it had anything to do with all that surfing you used to do out in Hawaii? He took me surfing once, this young guy. Once and once only. I'm just paddling out. I got a headache. Hold my head up. Oh, I made it up on this big board. I rode the wave. I surfed. It's like Nick Nolte and Robert Redford in their movie, you know, walking the Appalachian Trail. They walked like for 2 days, and then they were like burned out because they had these old farts trying to walk the Appalachian Trail. But Nick Nolte said, we walked the trail. Didn't bother to say part of it. We walked the trail. Makes for a good movie. Many times people view life as a journey. Poets say, circle round and round and round and discover the place that you've always been, where you started for the first time. See, because that innocence, that vulnerability, and I mean that in the most open, not fragile necessarily, sense of the birth, repeats itself at the death. The parents are taking care of the little one, bringing it in, and then as the aging process goes on, now the little one has become big, and the feeble older one is being taken care of by the little one who's now become big. And so it goes. And it goes by sometimes so fast. A lifetime. And so what do? Sometimes we measure things, and we measure things against other things. Trying to what? Make sense of it, maybe. The nature of awakening allows things to be seen in true perspective. Not a belief system. Not an emotional orientation of liking or disliking. And let's be also very, very clear about the nature of awakening and being awake. It is not about emotional, psychological, physical comfort. And it's not about emotional, physical, psychological discomfort. It's about at least beginning to see that this oscillating, relative, comfort, discomfort phenomenon is happening in something. It's happening, if you like, before something. You could take off the word be and just put it's happening for someone. Because it's exactly the curriculum that the human needs. It's exactly the learning that the human needs. It's a perfect design. Samsara, cyclical, wandering, perpetual ups and downs are exactly the curriculum that the human needs to awaken. With a very different perspective on unsatisfactoriness. Your mind may have grabbed a hold of the idea that waking up, finding true nature, whatever you want to call it, enlightenment, whatever those words are, is about transcendence of unsatisfactoriness. Inserted into that blindly at times deluded view, I am not awake. I am experiencing unsatisfactoriness and I am going to awaken and be satisfied, contented, happy, peaceful. And the answer to this one is no, you're not. Not that way. What I'm pointing to with my little goofy line here is the idea that you are going to, as somebody, awaken out of unsatisfactoriness. The actual nature of awakening is the death, the ephemeral, transitory, unlasting, and therefore dying, birth and dying, nature of this I, or me, or self, that was unsatisfied and has become unsatisfied. Seeing through, there's awareness of it, seeing through the ideation of path, of evolving from unsatisfactoriness to satisfactoriness, seeing through that as an empty, ephemeral dance of particles. That's what awakening is. And therefore it's said, mostly in the non-dual or Zen traditions, no one awakens. You don't exist. Words that trip up the brain. You're not who you think you are. You can get away with that one usually. Yeah, you're right there. Thoughts are not really making it here. Not really covering the bases, but they do fly around. Again, the good news is, just in case you don't have 40 years of uninterrupted, in a cave practice, to get your asanas, your diet, your breathing, let's not forget that, perfectly balanced so that your brain shuts up. Beginning to see the thoughts do come and go. Doesn't matter what it's about, doesn't matter how long it lasts, thoughts come and go. And the more that's recognized, the more the opening or portal starts to appear beyond conception. And you didn't spend 40 years silencing your mind. Because what would happen if you spent 40 years silencing your mind? Meanwhile, inside you had a very strong I thought down there on the bottom that was now saying, wow, I silenced my mind, now I'm quiet. And believe me, this has happened. You get these, I got nothing against them, I think they're just a little disturbed sometimes. They get enlightened, and I'm enlightened, you're not. They come right out of India and they end up in America. And next thing you know, they need 7 or 8 or 9 Rolls Royces. One's not enough. They get taken up in the energy of being adored. They get taken up in the energy of what it's like to believe they're enlightened and powerful. And boy, there's a lot of people who will like pay money, get on their hands and knees, and kiss the feet of somebody who says, I'm enlightened, and I can get you enlightened too. What's missing from that, very, very, very profoundly missing, who is the I that's going to get enlightened? And there's a simple, simple answer. Nobody. Therefore, true awakened nature in the form of the human being must always be primarily represented by generosity, kindness, gentleness, and let's not forget the biggie, humility. Because a human being who is awake sees themselves through the eyes, body, mind process of every other human being. They recognize, even if you don't, that you and they are the same. And there's nothing to prove. And there's no empire to create. There's no groupie energy to feed. And thank goodness there's at least a few visible examples of this that have been available historically. Not too many floating about right now in the form that are known. Some sweet people, no question. But it's a really subtle thing here that we're talking about. It's sharper than a razor's edge. And the egoic mind loves to own the best it can. It's not a problem. It's not even a situation, really. It's an opportunity. Just pay attention to that I am consciousness. Awareness sees the I am mind. I am whatever comes after. I am that I am. Or Popeye. I am what I am. It's all the same. We also talked recently about the usefulness of turning towards awareness intentionally. Because if you don't pay attention to that which sees experience, inevitably what you end up looking at over and over and over and over and over and over and over, one more over, two more overs, three, one more over, is experience. And it turns out that awareness and experience are inseparable. There's no two. And yet, unless awareness is recognized as distinct, not separate, as distinct from phenomena, just enough, then it stays obscured in phenomena and the mind identifies with the phenomena as me. This is not a difficult thing to consider. It's just a fairly rare thing unless you get around somebody who's pointing at it. The mass of humanity largely is trying to feng shui their experience in different ways right now. You know? If it's quite uncomfortable, they're just trying to get by. Can I get some food today? Shelter tonight? You're like my relatively upper middle class California friends. They're busy trying to figure out the next dietary practice that will fit their awakening nature that they're believing will be fed by just the right amount of omega-3s. Should I get from the right source? Probably going to be the costly one, but that's okay. Got to shift and just balance the saturated with the unsaturated fat. Because we've got to get the ketones going. We don't get the ketones going, and the brain is continuing to just live on this thing called sugar. And that's not really as enlightened as having a ketone body free, floating around in here, keeping your brain alive. Because that feels like you just ran a marathon and it's over. Not, it's happening, it's done. So you've got a lot of people who are smart with the research behind them saying, this is the way to go. Look at these Inuits. They had a fat-only diet. They're not going to throw up the slide right next to them that says, what happened to their bones after 50 years of eating almost entirely fat? We're not going to consider that fact because it doesn't fit our model. This would blow the whole thing if we said, well, they did great, but they didn't write it down. But then when they were 50, their bones were so brittle, they just collapsed. Well, I guess I'd eat blubber too if that's all there was to eat. You know, there's no cauliflower growing way up there where it's that cold. Extremes. And you go, well, let's see, let's find that middle way, let's find balance. What is that? Still, somebody's trying to find it. Now, look and see for yourself if awareness itself isn't always balanced. Check in on that. Check in on this. Is awareness itself ever disturbed? If you look for awareness, you can't find it because the very thing that's looking for it obscures it. Because it's nothing. It's the most direct, you could say, way, if you want to call it that, to see what emptiness is. Oh no, if you don't like that, you go ahead and sit for a few years, maybe 10, maybe 20. In my case, it took about 28 to begin to see that all the phenomena was empty. Nothing lasts, okay, nothing lasts, nothing lasts. That seems consistently clear. Behind that, like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain, don't look behind the curtain, Paul. There was Paul thinking, I am seeing ephemeralness. I am. I see it very clearly. I'm quite certain of it. What a prison. What a prison. What a prison in the name of, this is better than anything I've ever seen. It's true. What I've been taught is true. I can see it for myself. Everything is ephemeral. What was not recognized was, except me, back here, saying everything's ephemeral. The great good news is if you look back for the one who thinks they're seeing, everything's ephemeral, or saying anything, or doing anything, or being anything, you can't find anybody. You can't pin it down. And this is where many people just go, well, okay, so yeah, I'm going to go back to work. Or time to eat. Or just go back into their habits. Because it's completely and utterly not encouraged by hardly anybody to even ask, who are you? What are you? Where are you? Never mind, stay with that meditatively until something clarifies. And that something that's going to clarify isn't a thing. So I'm caught on words here now. It's not a something. It's more a nothing. And that nothingness or emptiness is completely and utterly undisturbed. It's what those guys, and were guys mostly, meditated and did the yoga and the breathing and the this and the that and the nostril this, through the head even, you know, saw, whatever it took, starvation, to see what? You're not a something. You're nothing appearing as a something. I know the words are weird, so we'll put a hyphen between the no and thing. No thing. Can we clarify that awareness is no thing? Meaning simply this, it's not an object of knowledge. It cannot be located. And yet it mysteriously, phenomenologically, is occurring. Isn't that amazing? If that isn't amazing, at least a little bit, it's okay. What it means is that you're amazed by the somethings. And those somethings keep coming and going. And when they're nice and they're here, you're like, yeah, it's great. And when they're going away, whoa. And then the check didn't arrive, and then this happened, and then that happened. And your car got smashed. My car gets smashed regularly, usually when I'm not driving. I just park it places. And the car I had before the car I have was smashed even worse. It's like, at least gave me a note. You just detached my bumper. You left my bumper sitting in the parking lot. Meant to be banged.
Maybe you're in a rush.
Just don't buy my car.
Yeah, you just bought beaters.
So notice what you're taking from this so far. Because if you realize there's nothing to get, then perhaps you begin to see there's nothing to get away from. And as you see a little bit into there's nothing to get and there's nothing to get away from, oh, whether you see it or not, awareness is waking up to itself. Because the dance of phenomena, the notion of getting away from something or getting to something, has calmed down. The music's not so raucous. See, we just don't sometimes get the help and encouragement to see the multiplicity of ways that the sun, if you don't mind me saying that, of awareness is shining. It's shining and there's nothing that can put that shine out. It's shining all the time. Even in deep sleep, it's subtly shining. deep dreamless sleep. Reason why this is a waking dream till it isn't is because everything that's happening in the waking state is subject to the same law, coming and going, just like the dream at night. If you'd like to understand yourself psychologically, behaviorally, emotionally, and perhaps if you're really keen and alert and get lucky or get help from those who understand the dream, night dream phenomena is way more illustrative of insight for insight in the waking state, but most of us were not accustomed to paying attention to it. We don't know how to make sense of it. It's too non-sequential. It doesn't have enough linearity. What the heck was that garage door doing in my room? My dream, in my room. And it goes away so fast. Oh, I know I dreamt last night. What did I dream? You didn't dream last night. You didn't dream last night. A dream appeared last night in awareness. You didn't do it. Just like you're not doing this. I am not moving my hands. The hands are moving. The brain says, I am moving my hands. You don't have to drop the I pronoun. Just know you're not it. And you can't think your way into I'm not it. I'm not you. It doesn't like that. It's like telling your thoughts, stop. And they go, it's like you put your hand on top of something in the world, like I don't know what to say this is right now. But you put your hand on something and it just oozes out. Goes around the edge. That's what thoughts are like. I'm going to stop. That's some like willfulness that's going to stop thinking. Come on, you got to be kidding me. That's like trying to stop the so-called potential, God, I hate to say this, but I got it, coming leaders of the free world. Get them to stop attacking one another. Like, let's up the ante a little bit more here, you rat. Can't wait to hear him like start talking in person. It's going to be great. You, it's like McCain when he went to bombing. That one is the most profound moment of like, what did you just say? We'll let it go. I'm glad I didn't say that. It's hard enough to think it now and say it here. That one. I don't know how you feel if you have a racist moment in your mind. A hating of the opposite gender moment in your mind. A homophobic moment in your mind. You probably ought to be. We all ought to be somewhat terrified by that. For a moment. Terrified, so you go, you see that? See, the problem often there is, oh, that's mine. It's my thought. If you walk around telling people, you're not your thoughts, you're not your body, you're not your emotions, you're none of this. Next thing you know, somebody just punches you. Now try this on. You're not this. Watch this. Boom.
Or they lock you up in a
room. That could happen. It could happen. I know somebody who escaped a situation of family trauma and a mother who dropped her off at foster homes 3 times in between the age of 3 and 13. Couldn't take her anymore, took her to the foster home. This is worse than a bus station. Get on a bus wherever you need to go. So you know what she did? She listened to the counselor. The counselor said to her, when she asked, how do I stop what's happening to me? I'm getting beat up by the stepfather. I'm coming to school bruised. How do I stop this? You know what the counselor said? I thought it was a very interesting intervention. Not sure I ever could have said it. If it had came into my brain, I'd probably go, I don't want to say that. counselor said, if you want to get out of this, you need to pretend you're insane. 13-year-old girl figured out how to act psychotic, and she got out of the abusive home where she was getting beat up, believing that it could be any moment that the stepfather was going to kill her. Believe her. She got out, she never went back. Because once they Baker-acted her, took her in and evaluated her, they realized she's not psychotic. And then she got lucky, and they didn't put her back in the system that she was trying to escape from, because the counselor was somehow right. If you want to get out of this situation, just pretend you're insane. People will do some amazing things to escape what feels imprisoning. But what's ironic and strange and mysterious is that so often we walk around, talk around, be around, we don't feel imprisoned. We feel this is the way it is here. A little bit more sensitivity. A little bit more sensitivity. Not a lot, just a little bit more sensitivity. Just a little bit less dust in the eyes. And you go, yeah. That repetitive I am, believing in the I am as what I am, that's a prison. What sees that? This is where the inner smile comes from. When human beings just a little bit start to crack through the veil of Maya illusion, they almost always smile. And it comes from deep inside. That's why they call it the inner smile. Because sometimes it won't even make it onto the face. If you watch people meditate, which I've had the good fortune to do, because on retreats when I'm bored, I just open my eyes and look at everybody else. No, I'm just kidding. Don't open your eyes, but I'm going to. But seriously, if you look around just a little bit and you watch people meditating, you'll see all kinds of things. Like Daryl was here last week, and Daryl said, can't you tell a lot by what you see in people's faces about like real what's really going on? Yeah, you can look at their toes and see a lot too if you know what to look for there. Don't get too interpretive and, you know, believe your mind about it, but just really stop and look, and truth reveals itself over and over and over. But you start to look and you see people like, you know, 7, 8, maybe 10 days of meditating, most people, unless they really got a burden they're carrying. You just see. You just see the smile starting to come through just a little bit on the edges. They're not like laughing like crazy. They are seeing through, whether they know it or not. That's why, in a way, I think it was so appropriate when Buddha was asked, what's the most important thing? He didn't say concentration. He didn't say enlightenment. He didn't say meditation. He didn't say any of that stuff that people thought he was going to say. He said the community. The community of like-minded. It's the most important thing. Oh, dear Buddha, why did you say that? Because we're the living, refractory, reflective, mirroring, dynamic gift. Don't forget. Don't forget. That's what's coming through people's eyes. That's what's coming through their faces. That's what's coming through their smile, I would say. Don't forget. That which is looking out is looking in. That which is looking across sees itself. It's that direct. It's not really the case that the eyes are the window to the soul. The eyes are the window to the true nature, which the soul is part of. You see, because as it turns out, eventually nothing's excluded. Everything is part of the true nature. Even those things that you say you now see you're not, relatively speaking, the true nature includes everything. negates nothing, transcends everything all at once. That's why it's transrational or translogical. It's prior to our typical sense of logic or common sense. It's prior to that. It's more simple. It's more immediate. It's more direct. That's why the Tibetans say it is closer than your very breathing. Or they say it another way, that which you are is too close to see. Too close to see. Eyes can't see it. Let me pause here. Is this your first time with us?
Yeah.
Thank you for coming. Any questions about this?
Is the girl okay?
The what now?
It's the girl. Whenever she...
The one that escaped?
Yes.
Yes, she's actually quite well. There's some things to work out still. Well, there's some work to do there. But she took the advice. She said, okay, I'm going to figure out how to be insane. And she put on a good act. It accomplished the goal, but samsara is still an entrancing phenomenon. You see, you get entranced by experiences, what comes and goes. And meanwhile, inside that, none of that's being recognized. None of that. None of it ever is being recognized without awareness. The first waking moment, let's say you remember the first waking moment. The first conscious moment. Was that in the womb? Was that like at birth? It's very interesting how the brain works. We still don't understand a lot of it, but we're trying to understand more, those who want to invest in that approach. Neuroscience is established now. They believe completely, based on their model, that there is no I, self, or me in the brain. It's just neurological, electromagnetic, H2O charged phenomena. There's no I or self in there, except as a thought that comes and goes. They're like, yeah, we see that now. The problem is, If you look there and see it, you see, or you read about it, that doesn't mean it pops free here. That's why awake beings don't just move around and look at everybody, and everybody's immediately transported into that as well. That's interesting. That's why I think it's incredibly important to take full responsibility for one's situation. Way, take no external refuge, as the Buddha said. Don't believe the scriptures or the teachings or the mouth, out of the mouth of those who came before. See it for yourself. And the more that is accepted as the only way this works, bang. Everything is happening, no matter how hard it is, no matter how unwanted or so-called unfortunate. The curriculum, exactly what you need. This is what the New Age teachings would call perfection. They don't really understand it, but perfection is the true nature of things as they are. Or another way to say it, all there ever is what's happening. And what is happening is exactly what each of us needs. I don't mean want. Needs to awaken. The subtlety of that point combined with the ideas and views, well, just a millimeter or less off of that, it doesn't seem that way. it doesn't seem like this is exactly what is needed. I don't live in that abiding realization. I think GRU is ripping me off. I mean, a little thing happened today, you know? Like, you go online, a weird world, it's interesting, right? It's not actually a world. It's just nothing. It's like you don't actually have a mailbox, all right? It's just a word, right? There's nothing there, okay? Anyways, go online, and all of a sudden, locked out of the bank accounts. Well, that created some interesting sensations. I wonder who's locked in. You know, it's like the mind just kind of went into this whole thing. So I tried a couple of things to, change it, and it didn't work. So when that happens to me, I just give up, usually. And if I still have interest, which I did, right, because I wasn't going to go eat lunch now, I figured, I don't know how to look at the accounts, and there's too many of them to begin with. I don't want that many. It's like people have too many credit cards. You know, it's called having a family. Everybody needs an account, and things open up like that. It just, watch it. It doesn't have to be like that, but it happened to me, so maybe you can guard against it. Anyways, I think, well, you should do something about it. So I call the person on the phone, and I get the person. I just yell at the thing when they say, they'll say, agent. Agent. Agency to agent. And see if it responds. And sometimes the thing just hangs up if you yell too loud. At least that's my experience. Anyways, it did hang up, and I get the person on there, and I say, this is what's happening. There's no entrance. She was sweet, and I'd like explained it a little bit and let a little emotion into it, and I heard her in the background like, ah. It was like she was empathizing. It's like, great, this is good, it's working, I like this. So I kept going, and eventually she said, well, sometimes this happens because somebody else's username is enough like yours now, so they're going to lock out the password. But we don't really know why it's happened. I love that one. The mystery has just appeared. We don't really know why this has happened. But just go ahead and do this and do that. And the next thing you know, everything was so-called resolved. So I thought, all right, I'm going to get a password that's so complicated that I can't even remember it. I'll write it down in 6 places, because I never write it down. I'll write it down in 6 places, but only remember 1. And then if I remember the 1, maybe I'll remember the other ones. But anyways, I write it down, says, oh yeah, this is a great one. Nobody ever made a password like this. And I thought, you should have just had lunch. The mind has no pride. It will do anything. And here's the key. The mind will say, this is working. This is not working. What sees that mind? Okay, because what sees that mind is always working. The mind goes, this is working. This is not working. We have to do something so we can get it so it's working again. Meditation is definitely working when that mind appears and says, this is working, this is not working. What sees that so-called division of powers?
What I'm seeing is, like, for me, when you were talking about behaviors, examining behaviors, that line of, awareness and then turning to self-absorption.
Turn what's it again?
Self-absorption.
Yeah.
Or, some navel-gazing, and then you're caught, you go. Or I sometimes, I'm wondering, like, currently in my life, I'm examining some behaviors, seeing that reflected back at me and personal things and wanting to take responsibility for them. And then also finding that the I is so strong as I do that.
Yeah.
I know it's not I know personal growth is not an exercise in self-absorption, but I find it I so easily do.
Oh,
And when I meditate, it does so easily, like, the mind going into, like, right and wrong, and that whole dance. And awareness comes in and sees it, and then it all seems like such a game, of course.
Mm-hmm. But
examining behaviors is like that whole personal growth.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that, Chloe, because the whole notion of a personal growth, I've been describing it here as just feng shui in the aggregates.
Yes.
Feng shui, the body, the feeling, the thought, you know, and the consciousness. Oh, we're going to feng shui the consciousness. Like, whoa, now we're getting to the crown jewel of it all, right? No, you really just feng shui the I am, and it's very, very insidious. You're right on. It's very pervasive. It's like a tight muscle. And it's agonizing to see clearly. It's very, very disturbing for some human beings. That's why they don't look. It's very, very, very profoundly disturbing to see how pervasive this clinging. That's why the Buddha said the cause of suffering is clinging. And the reason why there's clinging is because there's ignorance of the truth. And what he was saying was there's ignorance of your true nature. Doesn't mean you're stupid. It just means it's not clarified. And when it's not clarified, the I in the name of personal growth, which is like, there's a monopoly on it. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying it happens. It's the curriculum. Every single I, every single ego structure that ever was, could be, will be, is being manifested, will appear and disappear. Pop. It might take a long time to pop some of them. Some people, the ego is so, I am is the same as ego. The ego is so pervasive that the body is dying and the ego is there like, and just the life force goes and what happens? Who knows? No release. Death happened, no release apparently. And people are like, oh my gosh, what then? Oh, so-and-so fought so hard. Relatively young, I call him young, he's in his 60s, friend of my son's, passed away just last week, and the story went, I wasn't around the guy, I met him once, but the story went that he just fought so hard, he was so, you know, willful, fought so hard, he stayed alive longer because he fought so hard. I don't know. That's okay, I guess, if that's what you got to do. Fight. Don't let go. Keep the breath. You know, you're not going to leave me. Keep the thought going. You know? Keep the eyes open. And then there's one of my most recent last Vipassana teachers. Very interesting, unique, brilliant British man who was in Thailand early on, receiving the Vipassana teachings from this powerful Thai monk named Achin Dharmadaro. Achin Dharmadaro was a family man. At a certain point, he just saw clearly what he needed to do. He went into a room. He went into a room by himself and he stayed there for like 4 months. He didn't come out. When he came out of that room, he was just very, very transformed. He became a very powerful teacher. My teacher was drawn to him. They used to meditate outside next to the rice paddy in South Thailand. My teacher, at that time, he had 5 years under his belt. That's called a PhD in Dharma. If you're under a good teacher. Okay? If you're under a good teacher, then 5 years is minimum for the PhD. He had that well done. And he was meditating intensively. And he was into standing meditation. So we sat for 45 minutes. He used to stand for 3 hours every day from 12 noon to 3 p.m. And him and another monk, older monk, Thai, older monk, would stand side by side with a tree in between them. 3 hours, 12 noon to 3 p.m., and then they'd go have tea. Not a word was spoken. It's the practice. Recommend some standing meditation. You just stand still, don't move. Just let it open up. You want to feel what this thing's capable of connecting to? Do a standing practice. Sitting will do it. It just takes longer. So I tell you this story because this monk, older monk, he got cancer, so he couldn't stand as long. He went from 3 hours to 2 hours, from 2 hours to 1 hour, from 1 hour to half hour. He couldn't stand because the body was breaking down. He said, "You got to go to the hospital." So they made him go to the hospital. He didn't want to go because he wanted to stay in the monastery. They made him go to the hospital. Doctors are treating him. And then he demanded that he be taken back. He said, "Hospital's no place for me. I'm out of here. I'm going to go back to the monastery." And he took him back to the monastery and he got him the lying down meditation. So you want to get this meditation down. You want to get the standing meditation down, walking meditation down, so you can get the lying down meditation. Because it's going to come a point where you can't stand up anymore. Unless you have, you know, car crash and die that way. Natural death or old age death is going to go from sitting oftentimes to laying back or lying all the way down. Or if you, like my parents died of pneumonia, so they were reclined slightly backwards. If you lie down all the way and you have pneumonia, then it's going to be very difficult for the breathing, so you have to stay up. If you're really fortunate, you can die sitting up. Imagine that. Anyways, older Thai monk had a cancer. He couldn't do the standing meditation anymore, so he's doing lying down meditation. And my teacher was lying beside him on that wonderful day of transition. And it's just with the pulse. And the monk began to talk about his experience. And he said it like this. He said, "Lord Yarma," that's the Buddhist personification of death, "Lord Yarma is looking for me all over the universes and cannot find me anywhere. My eyes can't see. My ears can't hear. His senses are gone. He's completely lucid and awake. And then no struggle, no fight, no pulse slowly goes out. Pulse slowly goes out. No struggle. This human being is established in the deathless. That's why he's saying, 'Lord Yama is looking for me all over the universes, can't find me anywhere.'" Ha ha, he's laughing. Within minutes of passing. And that night, at the monastery, 600 or so in attendance, villagers came. I asked my teacher at that time to give the talk. And of course, the topic was about his relationship with this monk. And he gave the talk that night. And at one point he said, "I believe in my heart that this monk, Po Longput," his name, Po Longput. Po Longput is an arahant, enlightened, fully enlightened being. Spontaneously, 600 people, sadhu, clapping, sadhu. Sadhu means well said. That's the joy, that's the potency, that's the sun beyond the sun. "Lord Yarma is looking for me all over the universes and can't find me anywhere. I'm free." There's a bonus prize to awakening in the body-mind process as the vehicle for that awakening, and that is the fear of pain, the fear of death, the fear of the so-called unsatisfactory, the fear of the darkness, the fear of the light, lessons. It's a byproduct. It's not the purpose. The personal growth idea would be, let's transcend fear. Let's become flexible. Let's become rich. Remember, the law of attraction. The so-called secret. That's not a secret. The law of attraction is no more important than the law of repulsion. Hello? But if you want it, be able to have it. Who's the one who's wanting that? It's the one who's miserable. Because when the wanting is gone, where is the unsatisfactoriness? I'm not saying wanting has to go. I'm saying something quite different. What I'm saying is there's never anyone who had or didn't have the wanting. See that, and then watch what happens as a byproduct of that. Watch what happens to the nature of wanting things. If you like certain things, like right now I like mandolins. I used to like bicycles. And at another point I liked Hawaii. And I liked whey powder. It just keeps changing, like, and it goes away, you know. I talk to young people and they say, well, did you ever smoke pot? Oh, yeah. What happened? It went away. See, what you can't say to young people is, you're going to go away, as you think you are. All your desires and all of what you want is ephemeral. That's when you get attacked. Or people just won't listen anymore. See, what's going on here is rare. You're still here. This is your first time. You may never, ever come here again. For very good reasons. Yeah, it's much more popular to have a personal growth agenda. And let's feng shui the I am consciousness and not accept, not really even consider that we don't know what the heck we're doing. We'll just pretend that we know what we're doing. And there's a lot of strong, confident, you know, well-trained, I'm not saying they don't have integrity, human beings who are very, very connected to their belief system. And they've got others who join up. It's a phenomenon. It's not just Scientology. It's Gainesville Health and Fitness Center. It's sweet. I mean, if you like it, you know, you can exercise your earlobes. There's a machine for that. You just stick your earlobe on there and it'll go like this. And it gets stronger. It looks better. $30 a month, your earlobes are stronger. So I'm not bashing any of this. It's not critical. It's not pejorative. It's not judgmental. It's not put down. It's simply the contrast you made there, Chloe, so well. The personal growth, idolatry, isn't even a house of cards. Because a house of cards actually is there. What we're talking about isn't even there in the way that we tend to think and believe it is. So what I'd like to do, if I can, is continue to dissect this area that you very much helped me, us, go to last week particularly, but because it's such a critical piece. We could spend a bunch of time talking about how to practice loving kindness. Now, let me just close on this point if I could. Loving kindness was so revered during the time of the Buddha and after that time that some beings, to this day, I met a monk once who believed this. He said, the Buddhist core teachings were not about insight. The core teachings were about loving kindness and compassion. It got obstructed and obscured through time. And he had a case, and he had scriptural stuff behind it, and he had profound varicose veins from sitting in Burma for 8 hours a day, which I thought was kind of interesting. But why didn't you just get up before your veins turned like that? That doesn't look good. He didn't seem to care. And that's an aside. Anyways, he believed wholeheartedly and taught that the loving kindness, compassion teachings were really the heart of the matter, and that the insight teachings were secondary, which is not the way it's being taught and brought into our culture. It is not what my teachers were taught. He's very, very unusual. And I listened to this monk and I felt, this is very good. I'm going to sit with him for whatever time I can, learn what I can. Oh, but he wasn't wrong. He just had it dualistic, you see. Because if you see what insight is, and you see what love is, you see that love and wisdom are the same. It's just two different words that suggest something different. So that monk, for whatever reason, got lined up with us loving kindness and had a lot of interesting connections and teachings there. Yeah, he had been experiencing a lot of insight meditation too, but he lined up over here. You see, and he was subtly against this. And then you got other people that say, well, no, the insight teachings are really what's up. The loving kindness is auxiliary. It's a little bit of this against that. You see, the truth doesn't go against anything. Because it's for everything. That's justice, finally. Equality. So here's a piece. The mind, like I said, has no pride. It'll do anything if it's not restricted. Doesn't mean actions have to follow that mind. That's all another's teaching. Okay. But this thing is wild and crazy. And the more it's not inhibited, the more it goes, I'm going to take you on a roller coaster ride like you have never been on. Watch. You never need any substances to stimulate you again. I'm perfectly adequate. That's frightening sometimes because the dream will do this and this will do that. I mean, it doesn't necessarily just calm down. As it illuminates its nature, it doesn't calm down. It goes, and then sometimes it does that too. All of it. So let's just say you find yourself suddenly aware of defiled thinking towards another human being. And that means just a little bit of judgment about them, their behavior, their look, their smell, their whatever, hair, their political view, whatever. Just a little bit. Insight meditation would say, watch that and see the ephemeral nature of that thinking. Just see that it's not solid. Watch it come and go. Just watch it come and go. Okay? And then you sit back and watch that happen. You go, okay, great. That just calmed down, no problem. Or you go, oh, let me find that which is aware. Step back from the phenomena, turn awareness towards itself. And then look back at the phenomena and see what happened to those so-called judgmental thoughts about anything, including this. Third move. Just utter, silently, whisper towards that being, whether it's this or that, may you be happy. May you be at ease. Make it up. Don't read some scripture that says, may you be happy first, may you be peaceful, and then may you be free from suffering. That's one way. Happy, peaceful, suffering. Okay, remember that, Paul. Repeat after me. No, make it up authentically. See if you can find a way in which the heart is love. I used to never do what I'm now describing to you. Because I would just watch the thinking till it faded out. Doesn't have me anymore. Because I believe that it had me when it was happening. It had me when it was happening. And now it doesn't have me. Now it's not happening. And then one day, after learning the loving kindness, I decided to actually see if I could apply it spontaneously instead of in the formulaic way. I just noticed, oh, there's some negativity in the mind about so-and-so and what they're doing. I find this very handy these days for Donald Trump. Very handy indeed. I don't know who gets your going, but just try this out. Drop the thinking and notice, may you be happy. Not formulaic. Just stay with that one if you want. May you be happy. okay, be happy. Keep it going a little while. And then look at your mind. Look at your perception. That's a formulaic, even though you're making it up, version of loving kindness, because the loving kindness and compassion that I sensed the Buddha was emphasizing was not a formula. It was pure, nonverbal energy of the heart, mind, body, open, wise, loving, simultaneously. The Sagadana Maharaj says, love tells me that I am everything. Wisdom tells me that I am nothing. And between these two, my life flows. That's probably a good one to stop on. You are welcome to come again if you can tolerate it.